Our next speaker has spent about a half century now as a socialist militant. He started out as an organizer for the IWW in the days before the First World War. He edited an anti-war socialist newspaper in Kansas City during the war with an assistant by the name of Earl Browder. He was one of the founders of the American Communist Party, and in it became known as a leader of a group, the Cannon Foster faction. He was three times delegate of the American.
It reads, United Socialist Political Action in 1958 and the prospects for American socialists. This two-sided subject proposes action today and also proposes that we look ahead and try to see where we are going. As I see it, the two sides of the subject are equally important, and they are properly joined together. Unless we consider our outlook, it's not easy to take any kind of meaningful action anytime. On the other hand, if we content ourselves with looking at the future as we would like to see it and do nothing about it today, take no action in the direction of our goal, we would debase our vision into a daydream of mopers and idlers. Direction without motion is just about as useless as motion without direction. If we want to do anything meaningful and purposeful in the present day, we have to look ahead at the same time and see the general direction of our goal. And if we want to reach the desired goal without too much delay, we have to get started. We have to get going. That, I think, is the double meaning of the subject assigned to us for our discussion tonight. Our vision and our goal, to which our lives are committed and which makes our lives worthwhile, is the socialist society of the free and equal. And on the road to that glorious objective, and as the means of reaching it, we want to unite all honest socialists in a common socialist party organization. And as the next practical step, an experimental step as we see it, in that direction, we ought to take a census of the socialist population of this country to find out how many people there are who will sign their ballot for socialism if it's presented to them. And to that purpose, we are proposing an electoral coalition of socialists for United Socialist Political Action in 1958. I believe that a survey of the present situation in the American socialist movement, in the light of past experiences, will show the feasibility and the timeliness of this proposed next step. There are important historical precedents for this procedure, as I will relate a little later on from the history of American socialism. We have to begin, of course, by taking a sort of survey of the present position, the present situation of the American socialist movement. Comrade Hallinan pointed out, and quite correctly, that as far as its organized form goes, it is not very imposing at the present time. In the discussion and exchange of views that has been taking place, particularly in the past 2 years, many writers in different publications have turned their attention to this question of just where we stand right now. One comment I read states we're at rock bottom. Another comment I read said we have no place to go but up. And then some real calamity howlers have expressed the opinion that we can't even go up or down or sideways, that all we can do is just sit there and twiddle our thumbs and perhaps wait for Moses to be discovered in the bulrushes and lead us out of this capitalistic Egypt. Well, I don't believe in unfounded optimism at all. But I think the reality is a little better than some socialists picture it. There's no doubt whatever that the present position of American socialism is far from good and far from strong. That's obvious. But what about the position of American capitalism? This is the other side of the picture. Well, she ain't what she used to be, that's one thing sure. Why, the general comment about this small segment of the world that aspired only yesterday to rule the world is very, very deprecatory. If you read the comments, ranging all the way from the colonial world to the very centers of American power in these days, the general concepts of opinion about the position of American capitalism is it's in a hell of a fix. I'm only telling you what I read. Nobody has any confidence except Eisenhower. And he's out on the golf course and doesn't know what's going on. They say he doesn't even read the newspaper. Now, we socialists don't need to conceal our own troubles. We got plenty of them. We who have survived the storms of these last terrible years know very well that we have been hurt. That is, by we, I mean the socialist movement, been hurt. The socialist movement in the United States has suffered heavy blows, one on top of another, for at least 17 consecutive years. First, there was the terrible reactionary effect on the labor movement and upon all American radicalism and even liberal thought by the Second World War and the Cold War that followed it, and the Korean War, all effects of which were reactionary in all directions. Then we have had to contend with the conservatizing influence of the long artificially propped up prosperity, which sapped the life of American radicalism in all its departments. And then we had to put up with the devastation and terror of the witch hunt, which decimated the ranks of American radicalism and liberalism and all departments of the socialist movement. And then, last but not least, among the troubles which we encountered, there have been the lies and the slanders, the suppression of free and independent thought, the disruption of solidarity among socialists, the disruption of fraternal relations and free discussion among socialists of different tendencies. And all this has worked to demoralize the movement and to discredit the name of socialism. All of these adverse factors have worked against us and have reduced the numerical strength and influence of American socialism. That's true enough. But in spite of that, a considerable nucleus, and this is the important thing, a considerable nucleus of undaunted and incorruptible socialist force has survived all of this adversity. And more than that, all these adverse factors have been changing in the recent times. For several years now, we have seen, if we have looked closely enough, we have seen a turn of the tide. Anti-war sentiment is stronger in this country today than it has ever been at any time in the last quarter of a century. One of the most striking proofs of that is the fact that for the first time since the early 30s, Hollywood dares to print anti-war movies again, and they are turning out to be the most popular movies on the screen today. There's a world of significance in this simple fact, which the movie manufacturers never dreamed of when they were making something to sell. Not only is the anti-war sentiment strong and growing, but the long boom propped up by military spending, which was dragged out so long by these artificial means that many people thought that capitalism finally had found a way to escape its own laws, this artificial boom, according to what I read in the most respectable financial journals of the country, has entered into a decline. They call it a recession, but they admit there are 5 million unemployed in this country, and that means that we're probably 6 or 7 million actually unemployed. And no place have I been able to read in the financial and economic columns of the various journals anywhere except in Eisenhower's speeches any promise that it'll get better next month. No, this month. This is the 1st of March already. He's got one day down already on his property. Anti-war sentiment is growing. Capitalist economic system is in decline, and with it the conservatizing influence of prosperity is in decline. And then in recent years we've seen the witch hunt slow down. That's obvious, isn't it? It isn't stopped by any means, but the witch hunt terror that all sections of American radicalism had to contend with in the past 10 years has been decidedly moderated, and people are raising their courage again in wider and wider numbers. And no less important than these favorable turns in the situation is the new atmosphere in the circles of American radicalism, in all circles. Free discussion and fraternization of all socialist tendencies, and sentiment for united action and regroupment of all the scattered forces, is the subject and the order of the day now everywhere. And I say that's a good day for us and for our cause, the cause of American socialism. And it doesn't bother me at all that if in a meeting such as ours we have some criticism of each other, and some things are said by one speaker that another can't fully endorse, that's not the significant thing about this great meeting tonight. The significant thing is that socialists of different tendencies stand together on the same platform and urge united action against the capitalist enemy. All these changes I have mentioned are in our favor, and we should take advantage of them, and we should see in them the opportunity for American socialism to enter a new stage of revival, which will carry it to new heights on the road to victory over American capitalism. In spite of all that's happened to discourage, to terrorize, to weaken and demoralize the movement, there are still a lot of socialists in this country, scattered around everywhere, organized and unorganized. The sentiment for socialism in the United States, even today, after all that has happened, is much bigger than any of the parties and groups. That we all know. Much bigger than all the parties and all the groups put together, as a matter of fact. And the potential sentiment for socialism, which the bankruptcy of American capitalism will generate in the next period, is 100 or 1,000 times greater than the conscious socialist sentiment at this present moment. That's the real situation as I see it, and the real prospect before us. We ought to take it as the starting point to put socialism on the map and wipe capitalism off the map. the basic aim in rebuilding for the future, as I think all present will agree, the basic aim to which we are striving is to regroup the scattered socialist forces and eventually to get all honest socialists together in one common party organization. But that will take time. Can't be done in a day. The experience of the past 2 years shows that it will take time. We'll have to take the process of collaboration and unification in stages. One step at a time. I believe the first step should be one of recognition, to which we of the SWP subscribe, to recognize that all genuine socialists of all tendencies, whether presently affiliated to one organization or another, are independent at present, that all recognize that we are part of one movement, and that we ought to work together fraternally in one field of action after another. Work together against the injustices and oppressions of capitalism. And that sounds almost like a revolutionary assertion. After the terrible experience of the disruption of solidarity. But most of you who are sitting here don't know that that used to be the unvarying practice and tradition of the old socialist and radical movement in America. In the time of Debs and Haywood and Vincent St. John, there were just as many differences of opinion and different organizations and as many quarrels and squabbles and debates as now. But it was taken for granted as a matter of course that when there was an issue of common interest against the class enemy, whether it was a strike or a labor leader arrested or some act of injustice committed against any section of the movement, that they all should work together in solidarity against the injustice. Now I say, on this point, I'm a reactionary. I want to go back to the good old days of solidarity and cooperation in practical action, despite the differences we might have. Fraternal cooperation and solidarity in practical action does not exclude differences of opinion, does not exclude discussion and debate as we go along. As a matter of fact, there's no socialist life without free discussion of differences. But the point is that while we discuss our differences, we should also remember what we have in common as socialists and act together in support of it and devise means to do it effectively. There are many different opinions being expressed in the current debate on the American road to socialism. And I think all suggestions and ideas should get an attentive hearing. But one thing is sure. However one may think socialism is going to come to the United States, one thing is sure, it's not going to be smuggled in. It's a shame to have to say that, isn't it? The cause of socialism can be advanced only by counterposing it to capitalism, simply, honestly, openly, and directly. Clever tricks designed to fool people into socialism are self-defeating, as well as dishonest and contemptible. I think we have had more than enough of that indecent horseplay already. The revival of the American socialist movement will really begin to get underway when we get back to fundamentals and come out in the open as socialists every day in the week and twice on Sunday. When we say that socialists should find a way to work together, especially in electoral campaigns, we mean, of course, real socialists. Socialists who, to use the words of the Communist Manifesto, disdained to conceal their aims. Socialists without false faces. What is a socialist? Well, I can tell you what he's not very quickly. He's not a Republican. And he's certainly not a Demo-Dixiecrat. He's not a member or supporter of any capitalist party whatever. I'm not stating this as an argument, I'm stating that as a fact. Capitalism rules and exploits the working people through its control of the government. Fact number one. And capitalism controls the government through the medium of its class political parties. That's fact number two. The unconditional breakaway from capitalist politics and capitalist parties is the first act of socialist consciousness and the first test of socialist seriousness and sincerity. Where did I learn that? Marx and Engels explained that over 100 years ago, so it's not hot off the wire. I personally heard Debs explain that 50 years ago in the election campaign of 1908. I heard Deb speak for the first time, and that's what he told me, and I never forgot it. That's what they said, Marx and Engels and Debs. But perhaps they were very simple fellows who couldn't understand that the way to get what you want is to vote for something that you don't want. They couldn't understand that the really slick and clever way to get socialism is to vote for capitalism. And to tell you the truth, we don't understand it either. And we don't intend to play that game. You can never hit a target unless you aim at it. There was about 20 years or so ago, there was an aviator who made history in this country by getting clearance out of the New York airport. The papers all signed and he was waved out on his way to Los Angeles. And about the time he was supposed to get there, they began to send up smoke signals. Where's Corrigan? They thought for a while maybe he was lost. No, he wasn't lost. Pretty soon it came over the wires that Corrigan had landed in Dublin, Ireland. They called him Wrong Way Corrigan. And he became a sort of a popular hero. There's a man that didn't know what direction he was going in. People thought it was funny. They didn't blame him. He became a public figure. And most people thought he was just fooling. He never meant to go to Los Angeles. He meant to go to Ireland all the time and see what the old sod looked like. And he was forgiven for his error in direction, but nobody ever proposed that he should be sent to a put in charge of the instruction of aviators, especially when it came to direction. And I think that when it comes to politics, we should tell Wrong Way Corrigans that they've got to learn directions first. Now, this is the meaning of socialists, specially called not a general public meeting, but a sort of an invitational meeting to socialists of different tendencies. All of us present here, I take it, are socialists of one tendency or another. Now let us ask ourselves, honestly and directly, how did we become socialists? How did we acquire that certain confidence in the bright socialist future of humanity, the great vision which has transformed and inspired our lives and guided us to the darkest days of struggle against this insane social system? Did we acquire our socialist consciousness because of our superior wisdom? I don't think so. We became socialists, each and every one of us, in the same way, because others who went before us explained it to us in earlier years. They wrote pamphlets and books and made speeches and explained things, and from them we learned. And the fact that we had to learn from others, does not that impose upon us the obligation to explain it to others yet to come? And if we, socialists, don't speak up for socialism, who will? If we don't spread the word, who will spread the inspiring word of a socialist outcome of this mad world of capitalism we live in? And if we have to do it, when do we begin? I believe the sooner the better. And here comes the importance of the subject we have under discussion tonight. The best time of all, the most fruitful time, to explain socialism is during election campaigns. When public interest is highest and we stand the best chance to get a hearing. Capitalist class rules this country in a complicated way through the machinery of bourgeois democracy, which can't shut off all avenues of public communication, even to minority parties, although they try their best. And the SWP, small as it is, has demonstrated in these recent years how we can force cracks through that wall and compel them to give us a TV audience and a radio audience, and even to carry notices in the newspapers and get a greater hearing for the ideas of socialism in a few months of the campaign. You can get all the rest of the year put together. That's why we say, as it was always considered in the past, that the purpose of participating in these elections as a socialist organization or a coalition of socialist organizations is not the hope of suddenly getting elected to office nearly so much as is the opportunity, the expanded opportunity, to make socialist propaganda. And in the economic and social storm that's now beginning to blow up in this country, with fear and insecurity about war and making a living or even existing on this planet, there will be more interest in social and political questions, and more people will be listening than at any time in recent decades. What can we do to make the most of it? That is the question. To make the most of this exceedingly favorable opportunity. The National Committee of the Socialist Workers' Party has expressed the opinion and made the proposal in an announcement in the National Guardian and in the Militant, the proposal that all honest socialists get together for united political action in the state and congressional elections of 1958. And that this action be taken as the springboard for a united presidential campaign in 1960. Now that's an outlook worth looking at, isn't it? That opens up the perspective, the prospect, if it is accepted by the other groups and tendencies, of pushing the whole socialist movement a bit forward. And I want to confess to you that this idea did not originate in the clever minds of the National Committee of the SWP. We learned that where we learned so many things by looking at the books and studying the history of what others have done before us. In the period just before this meeting, I spent a great deal of time going over once again the several excellent histories of American socialism that have been produced by conscientious scholars in recent years. I discovered there, which most of you who have studied the history perhaps will recall, that the Socialist Party, which was the first organization of American socialism to get a big hearing in this country, in the heyday of Debs, didn't come into existence overnight. Prior to the organization of the American Socialist Party in 1901, August, there had been a period of 10 years almost parallel to our own, of dispersal, of splits, of separate parties and groups contending with each other and fighting with each other, until finally there came into the chaos a note of solidarity. And the strongest voice for it was Eugene V. Debs. Debs had been a populist in 1896. But when he got through with that campaign, he made a break with all kinds of capitalist politics, became a socialist, joined with Victor Berger and others, and formed the Social Democracy, and later the Social Democratic Party of the United States. Debs didn't like DeLeon. The Socialist Labor Party was very dogmatic and sectarian, and impossibly centralized in its operations, was producing splits and expulsions everywhere, and there were isolated local groups all over the country who had belonged to the SLP or who couldn't find their way to join it, who still call themselves socialists. Debs didn't like the SLP at all. But when he was in New York in 1897, in a public speech, he called upon all his friends in New York to vote the Socialist Labor Party ticket. You know the reason that he gave? The very same reason that Hallin and McAvoy gave in 1856. Because our party hasn't got any candidates and it's the only socialist ticket in the field, and by all means, when you vote, vote socialist and don't vote capitalist. That's what Deb said in 1897. And in the year 1900, Debs was a candidate for president, not of a single party, but of a coalition, exactly what we are proposing today. A split-off section of the Socialist Labor Party and the Social Democratic Party of Debs got together. They had negotiations for unity but couldn't come to final agreement. They split apart, but they agreed upon a common election slate with Debs for president from the Social Democratic Party and Harriman for vice president from the split-off Socialist Labor Party. And they ran a united presidential campaign in 1900 that aroused so much enthusiasm and so much sentiment for unity that by August of 1901, they were able to bring all the forces together in a new party, and that was the way the Socialist Party of America was founded. And in the whole process, a great role was played by the Appeal to Reason, which was an independent socialist organ published in Girard, Kansas. The Appeal to Reason was a very broad-minded socialist agitational paper, but they supported the election slate. They supported unity. They supported the idea of all socialists getting together and contributed to the general stream of cooperation and collaboration and fraternal relations that eventually culminated in the foundation of the Socialist Party as a single organization in 1901, and then the great age of socialism in the United States for the next 10 or 15 years was underway. There are other examples. I read in my studies of socialist history that in Russia, the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks were split before the first Russian Revolution, 1906, 7, 8, the darkest days of reaction, split into separate parties at loggerheads over many issues. But when it came to the elections to the Duma, they got together and conducted a poll among themselves to agree upon the proportion of slates to one side or the other, and ran a joint electoral slate. And they had in the Duma, at the time of the outbreak of the First World War, they had Bolshevik deputies and Menshevik deputies in the Duma, the Russian parliament, both elected with the help of the other in joint election campaigns. A number of events have led up to our proposal. Not only the historical example, but some actions that have been taken by individuals and by groups that have led up to our proposal and made it realistic and timely. You recall that in 1956, the SWP, at the cost of tremendous effort and sacrifice, an immeasurable labor of comrades bucking the reactionary election laws to get on the ballot, ran a presidential slate of Dobbs and Weiss. And then in that election campaign, there was entered a new note. Whereas for many years in the past, no socialist or radical party ever cooperated with or supported or helped another party, in that election campaign, 1956, Vincent Hallinan and McAvoy in New York came out and said, in view of the fact that we have no candidate, we propose to vote for Dobbs and Weiss. and recommend that other socialists do the same. And then that was the first break in the situation. Then in 1957, last year, in the elections in San Francisco, where Frankie Barbarera and Jane here ran as candidates of the SWP, Hallinan and Billings and Hitchcock, all not members of the SWP and differing with us on many points, nevertheless recognized the importance of a socialist vote and endorsed our candidates and helped the campaign. And in New York, where the SWP ran a candidate, the American Guardian came out openly in support of her. And whereas the SWP in his previous election had gotten only 4,000 votes, in 1957 she recorded 14,000 votes in New York City. And the American Guardian played a role in all this progressive development, similar to that of the Independent Appeal to Reason in the early days. And a very significant thing happened in New York around the candidacy of Elizabeth Gurley Flynn and of Joyce Cowley of the SWP. The Communist Party in New York City, I'm sorry to say it, didn't run a candidate of its own, didn't support the SWP, and did all it could to elect the candidates of Tammany Hall on the pretext that the labor bureaucracy is tied to the Democratic Party. But they did nominate one token candidate for city council in one district. That was Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. And when they counted the votes in that district, they found that the vote for Flynn and the vote for Cowley was almost identical. It showed that the sympathizers and members of the Communist Party couldn't bring themselves to vote for Tammany Hall candidates, that instead of voting for a Wagner-Flynn ticket, they voted for a Cowley-Flynn ticket. And the vote was identical. And that shows that the real sentiment of genuine communist and socialist workers everywhere is one of revulsion against capitalist politics. And all they need is a sign to get together for a united socialist league. The SWP National Committee has taken this initiative and made this proposal after full deliberation. And a number of things followed one on top of the other. A half-page ad was inserted in the National Guardian to call attention to all those socialists around the country who read the Guardian, which is the most widely circulated of all radical papers. News editors are taking the most progressive and positive stand for independent action. Recently, I've been informed in correspondence from New York that several conferences have already taken place in New York between the editors of The Guardian, representatives of the SWP, representatives of the Communist Party, and prominent individuals from the former ALP, the former president and or chairman and secretary of the state ALP, and a number of prominent individuals such as Carlos Lamont and others who are known in the radical movement. And the process is going on. I don't know what's going to be the ultimate outcome, but already it has got to the point where they're talking the question over whether it's possible to put up and agree upon a united slate. In Chicago, I want to mention this as one of the most important developments of the times in the general direction of cooperation. There was held in Chicago 2 weeks ago, which according to reports in the American Guardian and in the Militant, 150 delegates, not delegates, but 150 people attended a United Youth Conference from 15 campuses around the country and from 20 cities. In the face of all the campus witch hunt and all the oppression against the youth to conform, 150 representing all tendencies in the movement, and all organizations, got together for several days of fraternal discussion of how they can work together in the future to build a single united socialist youth movement. Now all these incidents and events point in the same direction. I believe New York is the key to the situation, not because it's more important than California, although it is, Cameron. Whether we like it or not. It's because the center of all the movements is there. And if they succeed in New York to get a united socialist slate in the elections of 1958, all estimates of all participants in the conferences agree that they have a good chance to get 50,000 votes or more in the election in the fall. If we could get 14,000 votes in New York for a candidate of the SWP with all the prejudice attendant upon a single party such as ours, if all could cooperate on a statewide basis, it's very reasonable to say that to hope to get 50,000 votes on the state ticket, and that would put the United Electoral Party on the ballot as the legal party for the 1960 elections. That's what we're really shooting at. And if that happens in New York, the United Socialist Electoral Party will be in business, and then nothing can stop, in my opinion, nothing can stop a United Socialist presidential campaign in 1960. Not even the problem of candidates can stop it. Because when you look around, you can see that you have some very well qualified people. I can think of two, speaking for myself, I can think of two most likely candidates who have the highest possible recommendations, that they have had experience as campaigners, and they both got good jail records. One of them is Vincent Hallinan, and the other is Farrell Dobb. I'm only speaking for myself, but I think a lawyer that's honest enough to get sent to the penitentiary in this country for defending labor leaders is a mighty fine candidate for a Socialist Party of the Honor. And as far as Dobbs is concerned, why, we can make a publicity sensation out of him. He's one of the big leaders of the Teamsters Union that got sent to jail for being honest. The American socialist movement has been badly battered in the storms of recent years, but the new events, which I have briefly summarized, show that the movement is still alive and kicking, and is even looking up a bit. The prospects are brighter than they have been for a long time. We should take heart and hope, as Debs used to say, and work diligently in the coming days to turn the bright prospects into new achievements and new advances. The forces for an imposing demonstration of socialist sentiment in the 1958 elections are already present. They're waiting for the go-ahead signal. They need only to be aroused and encouraged and organized. And for this, As is almost always the case, there is no eloquence equal to the eloquence of action. The SWP does not claim to represent the whole movement of American socialism. We are only one tendency, but we aspire, by our example, by our agitation, and by our action, to be a constructive tendency, to be a catalyst of organization in the movement as a whole. The initiative we have taken puts heavy responsibilities on our small party, and especially on our full-time staff in the center, those overworked and underpaid men and women who carry the heaviest part of our load and whom we respect above all. They need our help and our support in this new endeavor because they're pushing outward, acquiring new responsibilities, undertaking more expenses. They need our help, and they're going to get it, in my opinion, from this meeting tonight. We're going to send them a sign of support that speaks louder than mere words. I know what I'm talking about because the members and friends of the SWP came to this meeting knowing what was going to be asked of them. The members and friends of the SWP are socialists who mean it earnestly. Socialism is the ideal that inspires our lives. Each one of us regards his socialist ideal as a member of his family and feels responsible for it and will not neglect it or disown it under any circumstances, any more than he would neglect or disown a child of his own flesh and blood. We think our socialist ideal, as it is incarnated in our party, is worth working for and worth paying for. That has been demonstrated every time and on every occasion in the past. And I'm sure that we will see another convincing demonstration of this attitude and spirit tonight when the chairman reports, without much embellishment, the appeal that has come from the National Committee for financial help, and ask you to answer in your own way.